So I'd like to give a shorter talk, about a subject that's connected, but a bit different. And the subject is a spiritual emergency, spiritual crisis. And it's connected because we were talking, and here I will summarize briefly what we talked about before. The tendency we have to spiritual materialism, namely to try and fit a spiritual life into our own framework of our self, our ambitions, our needs, and our comforts. And so, summarizing briefly, we talked about the tendency, for example, that we want spiritual life to make sense, and it has to fit somehow our logical, conditioned experience, or what we call rational and sensible, and not too wild. And we try and fit it to comfort, like I said, the upper middle way, the comfort of comfort-seeking tendency that we all have, or we try and fit it to conditions that we're addicted to, or that we say this is our spiritual path, but actually it's a path that just makes us feel better and getting on in life, and life is easier for us, and so we can get stuck in these ways. And as I said, spiritual life is deconstructive. It can be wild. It can be difficult. It can be boring. It can have lots of stones and rocks. And it may need us to be like Naropa or Milarepa, to really kind of burn up our own self and our own self-interest and our own protection through a lot of hardness. It may mean that for us. But sometimes the spiritual life does become so uncomfortable and so difficult that we really go into crisis. And it's just something that I want to pass to you as almost like some information that might help you to understand either yourself or other people who are going through crisis and going through real difficulty, and why that is, and a little bit what to do about it, but more to why that is. And I think that the spiritual crisis really means being overwhelmed, being drowned. That means that although the inner work can deconstruct the self, if it happens too quickly or too strongly, we can go in major psychological, emergency and crisis and vulnerability. And this may be because we are vulnerable from the beginning. It could be that we start off with a lot of being fragile and delicate in a way, and not having a lot of resistance, chosen. And so when things go a bit crazy in our inner life, we just don't have the capacity to hold the kind of wildness of the unknown, the self going to pieces. We may just from childhood be vulnerable, and there can be pre-existing things that really press our buttons. We may be abandoned as a child, feeling abandoned by parents that didn't really love us that much, or we may have a tendency for loneliness, or we may have a tendency for isolation. And then the tendency for spiritual comfort goes too far into those places that are basically pathological. For example, in the Goenka courses, there's clear tendency for people to feel intensive practice in the Goenka style, which is really Mahasi style, Burmese Mahasi style practice, can have a real tendency to withdraw, to cut off, to not be able to relate to life, to be locked into a kind of very internal process of meditation on sensations and on specific things and on a kind of place of withdrawal perfection, ki'ilu perfection, or inability to connect with the craziness of wildlife and making a kind of a prison from the practice. And this does really happen, and it's been many calls for help from vulnerable people that are locking themselves in their rooms and can't relate to life, and then the parents get worried and the people get worried, and they find themselves isolated or emotionally isolated from others, locked in themselves or unable to have relationships or unable to love because of quite a hard concentration practice, which can be very mechanical. And so there is an extreme there that we have to be careful. And people who are pretty balanced, it will be fine. But people who start off a bit unbalanced can go in these ways, and there have been suicides in coming out of Goenka retreats. It is possible that the world can fall to pieces, and a little bit of it is good, and sort of it's okay that the world falls to pieces a bit, because it's the world of conditioning. But if it's too much and too fast and too many pieces, leads to depression and confusion, anxiety, getting psychosis almost, getting overwhelmed. And here, sometimes the traditional Buddhist world doesn't help very much, because the Buddha didn't really address these issues. The monks didn't seem to have them. And there were many protections in the Buddha, which I'll talk about in a minute, in the traditional Dharma, which prevents this. But even in the texts as we have them now, the Buddha said there are sicknesses of psychological confusions. And that we have to be careful of them. But when we look and see what the confusions are, that like they seem to be what everyone has here in the West. Like we're all sick in some way compared to the traditional Buddhist way of looking at things. So in other words, the tradition doesn't help us that much. We're in another world now, and I'll explain a little bit why that is in a minute. I think that one thing to understand is that the self is primarily a protection and primarily a built to create boundaries to help our survival. And if it goes to pieces too quickly, we can go into major, major crisis. And here I want to tell a story of a friend of mine, Robert Beer, who I know he doesn't mind me telling his story, and he's still a friend of mine, very good friend, lives in Oxford. In the 60s, he took a massive overdose of LSD, and he felt he was dying. He was sure he was dying in one night. He died, basically. And after that was like 2 or 3 years of terrifying, terrifying life, where he was depersonalized. He saw himself in the chair, in the floor. He saw the floor looking at him. He saw the chair. He would sit down on a chair and feel himself falling through the floor. He saw demons coming out of the doors. He wasn't existing as a person. He was depersonalized. He would sit on a couch and then find himself the couch. He couldn't find himself. He would just have the couch. Or he would fall into the couch and become the couch. And he couldn't sleep because he was terrified he felt he would die. And so he used to walk night after night after night. And this happened for 2 years until he went to a Goenka course. And he told Goenka his problem, and Goenka laughed and said, I will help you rebuild a boundary. And what you do is you do screening in the body, the scanning, which is a classic Mahasi practice, but never leave the boundary of the body. So scan the body again and again and again, but always ending at the skin. So that way, building by practice, again, a boundary called my body. And he did that, and he was basically cured in quite a short time. And he was left with an extraordinary gift. And the gift was that he knew immediately, by looking at any picture or any statue or any work of art, he knew immediately what the artist was doing, what the artist intended, what the symbol of the picture was, who the artist was, how it was, all the symbolism was talking to him straight away, instantly, in any place. He used to go to churches and in England and just see every statue, knew exactly what it was saying and so on. And he, without any training, became, I think, is the greatest living Tibetan artist. And without any training at all, it just happened. And after that, he was always invited to Tibet to teach the old men. And they said he, because of his emptiness, a great, great master, Tibetan artist, entered his soul. And so he was taking on the soul of this great Tibetan ancient great master. But he was always invited to Tibet and Nepal to teach even people after in the monasteries, and he never learnt it all. And he wrote a book, which is an incredible book, which I have, called The Tibetan Encyclopedia of Tibetan Art and Iconography. It's an encyclopedia like that. He never trained anywhere. He just wrote it in a total encyclopedia, which is brilliant and wonderful. And he made hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of tankas and drawings and so on, which I have some of them in my house. And he lives in Oxford, yeah. But when he looks back on that, he would probably say he's not sure if the whole thing was worth it, because there was such pain in that 2 years of depersonalization. So we have to be aware that the non-self world can be very terrifying, we can't push things, because it can easily lead to this kind of crisis. I wouldn't say as extreme as happened to Robert, but many people, and not so many, but look, many people experience anxiety, fear, and sometimes panic in retreats. I would say many, but they get over it. A few, it gets pretty crazy. Mostly, they don't need to leave the retreat. It can be dealt with in the retreat, and it's part of the process, and it's just a little bit strong and scary, anxiety comes and so on, a bit of panic, but it's manageable. It is, in a few cases though, it gets overwhelming, and it can happen very quickly, or it can be a process that lasts months. And one of the problems of spiritual practice is that it, especially if you have a lot of concentration practice, it opens an inner space, an inner freedom in which pre-existing imbalances, psychoses, difficulties can become balloons. They can dramatically return in the space that you give them. So normally we live with a lot of control. Meditation is about actually undoing control. So the control we use in order to live includes control of thinking, what's sensible, what's higion, rational, shviut, control of the boundary of the body, we want to know where the body is and where it finishes, control of our behavior, that we're not too crazy around other people, so control of what we say, control of our emotions. So basically, all this control is under the supervision of the self. In meditation, we actually begin to undo this control because we don't regard it as so important anymore. The control is relaxed. And at the same time, there can be a lot of inner space where there's no thought or there's not a lot of thought, there's not a lot of story of who I am, and especially in concentration practice. And then in this space, sort of demons that are hiding in the unconscious can jump up and have a great time, have a great party. And we can feel totally overwhelmed by that. So I want to, I think the main thing I want to do with this talk is to actually explain some of the features of why this happens, especially in the West, and to give you a kind of understanding or a kind of a picture of the Dharma in the West, which we are all part of, and how this can create the problem. And the first thing is that in the West, the Dharma is a bit unbalanced. It's a little bit disconnected from, for example, Buddhist culture. The culture where Dharma has arisen has in it all the protections and all the rituals and all the language to make it part of life. And here we might find that the Dharma we're constantly against the stream, that we are kind of, the Dharma is an extra thing that which is not in the culture. And so, it doesn't have, that balance, that cultural balance. If you imagine that if it's in art and if it's in language and if it's in teaching, if it's in the schools, if it's in behavior, how people relate to each other, and then meditation comes. So it's coming on a basis of a very good ground and therefore less likely to be harmful. And in the West also we have another problem, which is a sense of achievement, a sense of pushing, which is quite a Western, it comes from the Protestant Protestant culture and scientific culture, which is achievement, getting results. And that's kind of pushing ourselves. And apart from that, we push ourselves straight into meditation. Whereas the tradition says, wait, meditation comes afterwards. First of all, you build a house with stones on seven hills, and then you can go and get your meditation subject. Or first of all, you learn like in the East today, in the Thailand culture, the first thing is you work with the paramis, you work with building a personality, generosity, you practice generosity for a year or two. If you go into a monastery as a young person, you won't be given meditation. You'll be asked to clean and help and be generous and serve a bit and be healthy. And then slowly you'll be given meditation. And in the West, what's happened is we've been given meditation as the first thing. And meditation is a plus achievement, plus effort. And all of that, it can be a recipe for problems. Because it goes straight to the mind. And apart from that, the West has a very strong psychological language and a psychological a kind of interest. It's very interested in the mind. And so along comes meditation and along with the psychological situation of the West. And the West has diseases which are psychological diseases which you don't find in the East, such as loneliness, isolation, alienation, narcissism, a lot of individuality. And all of that tends to be in Western culture. And all of that also brings a certain risk. An interesting story, quite a well-known story, about a Tibetan teacher that kept using the image in Tibetan teachings, and it is an image in Tibetan teachings, of compassion as being like the love of the mother for a child. And then some of the Western students jumping up and saying, but my mother didn't really love me and didn't look after me. And the Tibetan teacher finding it impossible to understand how that happened. It's just so far away from Tibetan culture that they were completely knocked out that such a thing could happen. They just didn't understand how that such a thing is possible. And we understand it, but, you know, it's part of our pathology of the Western world.
We don't understand the opposite.
Yes, exactly. And so this can lead, and here where we're talking about some of the things we talked about before, this can lead to quite a lot of spiritual bypass, where we get intensely into meditation practice as ke'ilu solving our problems, or making us a new person, or running away from what's difficult, and shutting off the noise in our minds, and it doesn't really work. As we said, this is a narcissism in a way. We want to use meditation in order to kind of find a refuge, but there's a limit to what we can do with that, and it can lead to disturbance, and it can lead to, if it's extreme, it can lead to us not being able to relate, and not being able to connect, and not being able to take our noise, and trying to all the time hide in a safe place. And a lot of that is if we try with too much samadhi. In the West, the practice that we've chosen to be the dominant practice in the Dharma is mindfulness and not samadhi. And this is the reason, one reason, that samadhi is a concentration practice and is really like pushing to cut the world down into a fine point. And it makes, it needs a lot of effort. And it can make for vulnerability, because then when things come in to that mind, they can be explosive. The mind becomes very sensitive, very open, very vulnerable, and one-pointed. And along comes vulnerability from childhood, and boom, in such a mind, it can go a bit crazy. So mindfulness has been chosen, in a sense, for this reason as well as others, to be more fitting to the Western mind, more safe, and it goes with always. Mindfulness goes with kindness, and this is another protection that we have in the Western meditation practice. So I think we're not so bad off. We're doing all right, and especially in, you know, organization like Tovana, which is very, very aware of all of this. The teachers are all very aware, of all these things, the risks and the difficulties and the imbalances and the balances. So I've always been aware of it myself. When I started Tovana, I was very careful to invite the teachers that would be fitting for the Western mind and will bring that balance. And so obviously Christopher and Yanai and Charles and Patricia and Tanisara and Kittisara and people who are really, who have that understanding and can bring a balance of softness, a balance of mindfulness, and not so much pushing, can bring in also the culture aspect of traditional, some tradition that holds it, and so on. So, we do benefit, have balance, I think, in the Dafka in Tovana, we have very, very little, real major problems. Hardly ever. I can hardly remember ever anyone going through the kind of things that happen occasionally with the Goenka courses. But we just need to be aware of it. So I think the bottom line is for you to be aware of these things, not necessarily that you have been through these crises or will be through these crises, but just to be aware that this is a world of that can happen. Generally, in retreats, every person has a different need. And I sent you already a kind of a manual of what to do with spiritual emergencies in retreat or out of them. I sent it to you, it will be in the email. It's really for teachers. But why I sent it to you is not that you're going to be necessarily using it in a retreat as a teacher, but because it gives a sense, it's quite wise, and it gives a sense of what to do, where to go, how to guide people in spiritual emergency. And in a very obvious way, if someone's coming in a retreat with anxiety, panic, or this kind of thing. For example, we ask them to engage with others, to be less isolated, to begin to talk, to be less concentrated, to not go into the hall. The hall is a kind of a pressure cooker, sir lachatz, so not to go into the hall, to work in the kitchen, so there's normal life, a sense of normality, a sense of bringing back the boundaries, and less in some kind of a hole, come out of the hole of maybe deep concentration, and then fear and panic and isolation. So these are some examples of things that you know about that we do on retreats. But every case is different. So in the what I sent you, there is quite a lot of interesting material on how to deal with these things. And from different teachers, including Christopher. So, in a sense, I think you'll be fine. I don't think it's really for you that this talk or this is not. I think you're probably unlikely for it to happen to any of you, because you've also had quite a long period in the Dharma, and it hasn't happened yet. So it's not going to happen from now. You've already gone past that stage, I think, and where this sort of thing is likely to happen, because it tends to happen with people who are sort of pushing at the beginning. They're pushing for achievement and driving themselves into a hole, and then things go crazy. But just as, you know, you should be aware that these things happen. And one other thing that I wanted to mention, there is a whole mind-body connection to spiritual emergency, which can be all kinds of body-mind phenomena, which can be quite uncomfortable at times and quite mysterious also. One of my daughters was going through a bit of a crisis, and every time she did Qigong, which is really gentle, all kinds of symptoms arose, and never any other time. The minute she did Qigong, energy work, which is just so gentle, whoop, crazy things happen in the body, and nearly sending her to hospital. And then it passed. But, you know, it can happen. These things with the body is a intimate relationship with the mind and with the spirit. And the three are not separate, really. So all kinds of spiritual experiences can be manifest in the body. Chakras can be overactive, meaning at a certain part of our power, like emotional, or a certain part of our body can begin to do movements, or begin to tremble, or begin to shake, or begin to have automatic movements, or all kinds of things can happen from based on energetic movements, which are based fundamentally on meditation, on the spiritual world, because it's working with the mind and with the consciousness. So it can happen, and these things tend to pass away, though. The body phenomena, they tend to pass, and very simply, we don't give them importance. If you don't give them importance, they tend to go away. And we don't make a story out of them, don't turn them into something, we don't get frightened of them, we just let them pass without giving them interest too much. So that can be useful, I think, for you to just to broaden your perspective on meditation practice, and especially as we practice it in the Western world. Thank you.